Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist Dave Lindor, who describes the Bush administration's possible pre-election plan to launch a military strike against Iran. Former Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman, who explains why she strongly opposes the Military Commissions Act, signed into law by the president, and why she believes the next Congress should move to impeach Mr. Bush. And Ryan King, policy analyst with the Sentencing Project, who discusses the reform movement that is working to restore ex-felons' right to vote in U.S. elections. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While the Bush administration pushes for sanctions against Iran and North Korea over their nuclear ambitions, it has balked at supporting a new nuclear weapons-free zone in Central Asia. In mid-September, the governments of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan, all former Soviet republics, signed a treaty pledging not to produce, buy, or allow deployment of nuclear weapons in the region. According to the news service OneWorld.net, the United States, along with France and Britain, boycotted the signing ceremony. The U.S. Embassy says it is observing a 1992 treaty between Russia and the Central Asian republics that allows nuclear weapons to be deployed in the region. Foreign Policy magazine called the Manas Air Base in Kyrgyzstan one of America's six most important military bases in the world. As the influential journal stated, Manas is located near immense energy reserves of the Caspian Basin, as well as Russian and Chinese borders. As Jackie Cabasso of the Anti-Nuclear Western States Legal Foundation observed, the United States is involved in a massive program overhaul of its nuclear arsenal. In fact, they're working to replace every nuclear warhead and all existing delivery systems. Central Asia has been home to a strong anti-nuclear movement, which reacted against 500 Soviet-era nuclear tests in the region, equal to the explosive power of 20,000 Hiroshima bombs. Last February, South Dakota passed the harshest abortion ban in the nation, making it a felony to terminate a pregnancy except when the life of the mother is at stake. Instead of contesting the abortion ban in court, which may have ended up in the more conservative U.S. Supreme Court, pro-choice activists decided to overturn it at the ballot box November 7th. Early polls show support for reversing the ban, but most observers expect a tight race. Ban opponents, including Planned Parenthood and NARAL, Pro-Choice America, say the abortion ban goes too far by not making exemptions for rape and incest. Pro-ban campaigners claim that many women now suffer from post-abortion syndrome. The claim, with little scientific evidence, insists women who had abortions now suffer from depression, bipolar disorder, guilt, and post-traumatic stress disorder. The American Psychological Association states there is no lasting or significant health risks from having an abortion. The rhetoric of anti-abortion activists asserting that abortions inflict long-term harm on women is nothing new. It was used to criminalize abortion and contraception over 100 years ago. In the 1980s, anti-abortion activists tried to pressure Surgeon General C. Everett Koop to declare abortion a public health threat to women. Koop, who opposed abortion, refused, saying that there was little evidence showing that abortion harmed the mother. Manhattan real estate mogul Howard Rich is spending $11 million to fuel a rebellion in western states against eminent domain laws. The repeal initiatives in Idaho, Arizona, California, and Washington state are also targeting existing land use laws, which could bankrupt state and local governments. The wave of ballot initiatives follows up on the 2004 Oregon initiative, which forces the state and municipalities to pay property owners compensation when land use regulation, such as zoning, reduces the value of land. In Washington state, the initiative could cost taxpayers $7 to $8 billion a year. According to the Washington Post, Proposition 90 in California is now opposed by conservative taxpayer groups because of the cost to local governments. Land developers, builders, and libertarians have long sought such anti-zoning measures. They went on the offensive after the reaction to the 2005 U.S. Supreme Court decision on eminent domain, Kelo versus New London, that upheld the right of government to condemn private property for commercial development. In Oregon, landowners have filed over 3,000 claims concerning 173,000 acres of land. They have won over 90% of the cases. In response, the state and local governments have waived various land use rules. As John Echevarria of the Georgetown Environmental Law and Policy Center observed, the agenda behind these initiatives is to make it so expensive for state and local governments to regulate land use that they can hardly function at all. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
Even as North Korea conducted a nuclear weapons test, setting off worldwide condemnation, the Bush administration had deployed a naval strike group to the Straits of Hormuz off the Iranian coast. The warships, scheduled to arrive in the Straits on October 21st, include the nuclear-powered aircraft carrier Eisenhower, a cruiser, destroyer, frigate, submarine, and supply ship. The mission of this armada is not known, but there are reports that angry naval officers within the Eisenhower strike group have told anti-war retired officers that their ships are being sent to launch a military attack against Iran. There is no confirmation that President Bush has ordered such an attack, and it could be a bluff designed to intimidate Iran. But if an October attack is carried out, the timing suggests that influencing the outcome of the November congressional election, where Republicans are on the ropes, may be a primary strategic goal. Critics warn that such a U.S. preemptive strike against Iran's nuclear research facilities would likely set off a wider war inside Iraq and throughout the Middle East, where Iran's allies are capable of launching counterattacks against U.S. targets. Both Time magazine and investigative journalist Dave Lindorf have written stories about the debate within the Bush administration over U.S. policy toward Iran and the concurrent deployment of the Eisenhower to waters off the Iranian coast. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Dave Lindorf, who discusses the possible war scenario described in his article, War Signals, which appeared on the Nation magazine website in September.
I had gotten tipped that this ship, which had been for several years in Norfolk to have its nuclear fuel resupplied, it's a nuclear carrier, and to be refitted and upgraded, that it was having its deployment pushed forward by a month. It had been scheduled to replace a carrier, the Enterprise, that's been operating for a six-month deployment in the Arabian Sea, but they pushed it forward a month, which has the effect of doubling the aircraft carriers in the vicinity of Iran for the period around the election. And the tips that I had heard were that it was in anticipation of a possible aerial assault on Iran, on its nuclear reactors. And as I investigated that, and I did get confirmation from inside the Pentagon that the ship was sailing early, and it did sail on the 3rd of October, there was also a story that came out in Time magazine within a few days of my article, which reported that the crews of a fleet of minesweeper ships had gotten orders to prepare to deploy effective October 1st. And you got to ask, why would minesweepers be needed in the Persian Gulf, since Afghanistan's a landlocked country and Iraq is not going to be mining the Persian Gulf? I mean, the government there is our puppet. And certainly the insurgents in Iraq aren't in a position to mine the Gulf. So who else would be mining the Gulf except Iran, and why would they do that unless we were at war with them? So that didn't look good. And then there were a couple of other reports that supported this. One was Gary Hart, who the former senator from Colorado and one-time presidential candidate, who has very good connections to the Pentagon and the intelligence community. And he said that his sources said there were, for some time now, there have been special forces operating in Iran, picking targets and getting the coordinates on targets for an aerial bombardment. And he suggested there were as many as 400 targets, including the nuclear sites and command and control centers. So that's a lot of stuff. And I guess the big question is, why would they do something so totally insane? Iran is, what, 70 million people. It's three times almost as big as Iraq. It has an 800,000-man army that's really well-trained and really well-equipped. It's not a bankrupt country. It's an oil-rich country. Unlike Saddam Hussein, they haven't been subjected to years of, you know, debilitating sanctions. And it also has a hugely nationalistic population that if you attack it, rather than falling apart like Iraq, it will band together. And so why would we do this? They can turn the Shia militias on our guys in Iraq, where we're already losing the war. They can mine the harbors, and it'll shut down the entire oil industry in the Gulf, destroying the global economy. Well, the only possible conclusion would be that they would do this before the election to influence the election, and that's what my conclusion is. It's the first story I've ever written that I hope I'm wrong on.
If the thought or strategy within the Bush administration is that the United States citizenry would rally around this president and the Republican Party after hostilities are initiated against Iran, this, of course, could not be a simple U.S. surprise attack. There has to be something a little bit more devious at work here in terms of a pretext for war, which might include provoking Iran to blow up one of our own ships, providing a rationale for the American people to be, you know, 100% behind the president's reaction, whatever it is. You know, it kind of looks like there may be a Gulf of Tonkin resolution here at work.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, that would be the logical thing to do. The Iranians have a lot of fairly sophisticated anti-ship missiles provided from China and Russia. And so you can imagine a scenario where they just do sort of prodding with ships, putting them in harm's way, interfering with Iranian shipping, you know, getting in position as targets and then taking a hit. It doesn't require the sinking of a carrier. It simply requires a trigger-happy person on the Iranian side firing a rocket, even if it didn't hit, it would be an act of war and give the justification that the Gulf of Tonkin was used to give.
Do you think the American people would rally around the Bush administration and the Republicans before the election if the U.S. launches aerial attacks against Iran?
Sadly, I do. I mean, I think that it would very quickly become apparent to people that this was what it is, which is a criminal enterprise by people who really are committing an act of treason against the country. But I think that the initial reaction of Americans to a report that the U.S. had knocked out Iran's nuclear facilities, which would be reported, you know, very jingoistically by the American media, as usual, I think people would cheer and say the usual thing, oh, you know, Bush really stood up and did what he said he was going to do, and we had to take this out before they got the bomb. And I think that enough people would do that that it could effectively swing the election. And then, you know, from Bush's point of view, nothing else matters. He's got a completely compliant Congress that doesn't hold him to anything. He's got a press that will, you know, cover up all his disasters. And, you know, so we'll have another war.
That was investigative reporter Dave Lindorf. He is co-author of the book, The Case for Impeachment, The Legal Argument for Removing President George W. Bush from Office. To read his articles online, visit Dave's website at www.thiscan'tbehappening.net. As the prospects dimmed for continued Republican control of Congress in November's election, President Bush signed into law the controversial Military Commissions Act of 2006, affecting the treatment of U.S.-held terrorist suspects in Guantanamo Naval Base in Cuba and elsewhere. In comments made before signing the bill on October 17th, President Bush dedicated the legislation to the memory of the victims of the terrorist attacks of September 11th. The bill permits the exclusion of a defendant from his trial if classified evidence is being presented, and the admission of hearsay and coerced statements as evidence. The law prohibits a detainee from filing a habeas corpus petition challenging the legality of their detention in federal court. Another feature of the bill retroactively provides immunity from prosecution for U.S. personnel who engaged in harsh interrogation tactics from September 2001 to December 2005, while giving the president unilateral power to decide what constitutes a violation of Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions outlawing torture and cruel treatment. The law also expands the definition of unlawful enemy combatant to include anyone who directly or indirectly supports hostilities against the United States and gives the president the power to declare U.S. citizens enemy combatants subject to indefinite detention. The law is already being challenged for what critics maintain are serious violations of the U.S. Constitution. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with former four-term New York Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman, who served on the House Judiciary Committee during impeachment proceedings against President Richard Nixon. She explains why she opposes the Military Commissions Act and why she believes the president should be impeached.
It's shameful. And it's unconstitutional, certainly in parts. Congress has no right under the Constitution to abolish habeas corpus. We're not in the middle of insurrection, and we're not being invaded at the moment. It's a very sad commentary about where we are as a nation. There's no question that Abu Ghraib and the mistreatment of detainees, as President Bush himself has acknowledged, has inflamed anti-American feeling, has endangered our troops, and endangered the country. It's the wrong thing to do. One of the most egregious things about this act is something that very few people have spoken about, but I wrote an op-ed piece about it in the Chicago Sun-Times several weeks ago, pointing out that the bill actually contains a pardon for President Bush and any of his top-level people who may have violated the War Crimes Act of 1996. There is a federal statute which makes it a federal crime, in some instances punishable by the death penalty, for U.S. officials, any U.S. national, to mistreat a detainee in violation of certain provisions of the Geneva Conventions. Now, we know that the President of the United States was concerned about this. His top counsel, Mr. Gonzalez, was concerned about this as early as January 2002, if not before. And their present effort to alleviate themselves and others of liability for criminal acts is just breathtaking, because if crimes were committed, and the president has indicated that one of the purposes of the military tribunal bill is to give immunity to the CIA interrogators, but if they get immunity, so do the people who gave them orders, who conspired with them, who aided and abetted them, who authorized them, going way up to the very top under the War Crimes Act. Well, if a president can commit a crime and then get Congress, without debate, without discussion, without so much as a peep, to give him immunity for that criminal act, then that makes a total mockery of the rule of law in the United States. Presidents have to obey the law. If they violate the law before they're ever given immunity, this is something that deserves national debate, national discussion, what laws were broken, when, where, and how. The president has refused to disclose the instructions he gave to the CIA with respect to mistreatment or treatment of detainees. As bad as everything else is in that bill, it all stems from lawlessness at the very top. You cannot have a country that's become a banana republic with presidents violating the law, getting a pardon from Congress, and then going off to do the same thing all over again. This is not the United States of America. Shouldn't be.
Elizabeth Holtzman, if the Democrats should take the House of Representatives, can they in any way reverse this immunity that is signed into law?
I've begun to research that issue. It's not 100% clear that it can be reversed or can't be reversed. I just don't know the answer to that yet. But even if it's not reversed, there's no reason that the president can't be impeached for his misconduct and the role he played with respect to the mistreatment of detainees, the failure to hold those accountable who were responsible for the mistreatment of detainees, including those at the highest levels.
I'd like your comment on Nancy Pelosi's attitude on the question of impeachment. She says that a Democratic-led Congress under her Speaker of the House, which would be historic in itself, she says they plan to follow a positive, constructive agenda of legislation, maybe reversing some of what the Republican Congress has done over the last decade. But she seems to very vocally be dismissing the idea of impeachment. What's your take on that?
Well, I gather from this is I go back to Watergate when the Democrats were in control of the House and the Senate. And Richard Nixon had won his presidency, his reelection, by one of the largest landslides in modern history, in the history of the United States presidency. And information began to come out. He was reelected in November 1972, starting in mid-January of 1973. Information came out that implicated the president in the Watergate break-in. And more information came out. And then information came out about the president's secret bombing of Cambodia. And it wasn't until the American people basically got up and said enough is enough and forced Congress to act that Congress, the democratically controlled Congress, began impeachment and impeachment inquiry. And so if the Democratic leadership or other Democrats don't do anything about impeachment, it won't be surprising in terms of the historical past. But if the American people want impeachment, it's going to happen.
That was former four-term New York Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman, who served on the House Judiciary Committee during impeachment proceedings against President Richard Nixon. She is the author of The Impeachment of George W. Bush, a handbook for concerned citizens, published by Nation Books. As Americans get ready to head to the polls November 7th, some members of society will be allowed to vote for the first time since serving their sentences for felony convictions. In a new report, the Sentencing Project, based in Washington, D.C., explains that some states have repealed the harshest prohibition, which was a lifetime ban on voting for ex-felons. Other states are moving to allow ex-felons to vote once they leave prison, even while still on parole or probation. Two states, Maine and Vermont, allow incarcerated felons to vote by absentee ballot from their prison cells. On the other end of the spectrum, two states that used to allow prisoners to vote, Massachusetts and Utah, have withdrawn that right in recent years. The Sentencing Project believes that one's criminal status should have no impact on voting rights. The group advocates for polling places to be set up at all prisons to enable felons to vote, just as all other citizens have that right. The Sentencing Project believes that one's criminal status should have no impact on voting rights. The group advocates for polling places to be set up at all prisons to enable felons to vote, just as all other citizens have that right. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Ryan King, policy analyst with the Sentencing Project. He describes some of the voting restrictions that have been lifted, then explains why the total number of disenfranchised individuals has remained steady at 5.3 million despite reforms.
The changes that we've seen for the post-sentence, the lifetime disenfranchisement, addressed really states that had blanket policies, Iowa, Nebraska, and New Mexico. All three of them had blanket disenfranchisement, which means that no matter the offense type that you engage in, that you lose your right to vote for life and essentially need to go through some sort of either pardon or clemency process to have that right restored. There are now only three states that have that type of policy, and that those are Florida, Kentucky, and Virginia. There are an additional eight states where, depending on the type of offense that you engage in or when the offense occurred, you can lose your right to vote for life. So for an example, in Nevada, first-time nonviolent offenders automatically have their rights restored upon completion of sentence, whereas all other individuals are obligated to go through a restoration process. And so what we see in states like that is really actually quite a confusing process, because a lot of individuals are not properly informed of what the status is.
Where did the impetus for these changes come from? From ex-felons themselves? I know some have been speaking out about this, and also legislators working for change. But also, I know some good government types who say that this type of lifetime ban is completely undemocratic, and it's a continuing disenfranchisement of segments of the community, which tend to be predominantly African American.
My take on the whole thing is this, and that is that I think as of 10 years ago or so, the issue of disenfranchisement was not known to many people. There have been a couple reports that were issued. We did a co-report with Human Rights Watch in 1998, and there's been some other reports done to raise the profile of the issue, and of course the 2000 election, where there was such a slim margin in Florida, and the issue of felony disenfranchisement came to the forefront as one of the factors that could have possibly swung the election results. And of course there was accusations of people being wrongly purged and denied access to voting on election day. And so I think that really brought it front and center to the American public. And why I think that's important is because there's been subsequent public opinion polling that's been done that shows about 80% of Americans support post-sentence voting, so having your rights restored when you complete all obligations of sentence, including parole or probation, depending on what the sentence is. And about two-thirds support people on parole or probation voting. And so when you look at the national picture, which is that there are 36 states, for example, where persons on parole cannot vote, yet you find out that two-thirds of Americans support persons on parole voting. There's a disconnect there between what people think and what policies are, and that's a result of the fact that I think a lot of these policies, first of all, are quite old, have been around for a long time, and people weren't really aware of them. So from our perspective, I think what we're seeing here is momentum going forward because more people are finding out about it, more people are speaking out about it, and legislators, I think, are finally becoming aware that in a society, in American society, where democracy and voter participation is held to such a high ideal that, you know, there's a great deal of hypocrisy to, on one hand, say we're this beacon of democratic freedom, and then on the other hand say, oh, but by the way, we disenfranchise 5 million Americans for having felony convictions, which is essentially really a character test, the modern-day character test.
Ryan King, any polling done about allowing those currently in prison on felony convictions to vote, such as is the case just in Maine and Vermont?
For persons in prison nationally, about one-third of Americans support voting. So that would be about one-third of Americans support a system like we see in Maine and Vermont, where persons who are currently incarcerated are able to vote via absentee ballot.
Did you estimate that the number before these reforms was significantly greater than 5.3 million? In other words, has the number who have been affected gone down as a result of these reforms?
That's where my characterization of this report is one of tempered optimism, and that is that despite these changes, we still have seen an increase in the total number of persons that are disenfranchised. So it's the actual number right as of December 31st, 2004, which is the most current estimate, was 5.3 million. That was an increase from 4 years prior, which it had been at 4.7 million. And that is a reflection of a criminal justice system that continues to bring more and more people in. More and more individuals are convicted of felonies. Broader and broader reach as really the over-criminalization of behavior in this country, both at the federal and state level. And so as long as that continues, as long as we have these very tough-on-crime sentencing provisions and more people being sent away to prison, we're going to continue to see this increase in the number of people disenfranchised.
That was Ryan King of the Sentencing Project. Call the project at area code 202-628-0871. Or visit the group's website at www.sentencingproject.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.